headlines this hour. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman describes the presence of Israel in the region as a source of instability, underscoring Tehran's support for the Palestinian resistance. Russia says it has carried out fresh attacks against Ukrainian positions in the Black Sea region, inflicting widespread infrastructure damage. And thousands of demonstrators take to the streets in Niger's capital for the third consecutive day, demanding French forces to leave the country. Warm welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Iran says it regards Israel as an illegitimate regime and the expansion of its presence in the region as the main cause of instability there. The foreign ministry spokesman says Tehran has always raised the issue in its meetings with regional countries. Nasser Kanani says that Tehran has also emphasized the necessity of support for the Palestinian nation and the resistance front during the meetings. According to Kanani, the Islamic Republic considers Palestine the main issue of the Islamic world. Iran has repeatedly warned that it will not tolerate Israeli presence in the Persian Gulf region after two regional countries signed normalization agreements with the regime. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says respect for the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of all countries in the region is the most effective way to counter terrorism. Raisi made the remarks while meeting the Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan in Tehran. He touched on the cultural and historical commonalities between the two countries and expressed hope for an improved level of cooperation. He said the joint economic commission between Iran and Turkey would play a vital role in increasing commercial interactions. The Iranian president further emphasized the importance of effectively dealing with the presence of foreign forces in different regions, including the Caucasus. Fidan, for his part, said that Iran and Turkey have great capacities to expand cooperation. The top Turkish diplomat with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, and discussed a wide range of issues.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has paid a visit to the Islamic Republic of Iran upon the invitation of his Iranian Emir Abdullahian. In a meeting, the two ministers discussed the possibilities for further advancing bilateral cooperation in all fields and to exchange views on current regional and international developments. Activating the Joint Economic Cooperation Commission, strengthening political synergy, following up on neighborhood cases and consultation on regional security issues have been among areas of talks between Iran-Turkey diplomatic delegations.
We've discussed the implementation of the comprehensive plan for long-term cooperation between Tehran and Ankara that was concluded during Mr. Erdogan's visit to Tehran. The agreements between the two presidents are on the right track. We also reviewed plans to increase the annual trade volume to 30 billion euros, and good arrangements have so far been made to achieve that target.
Negotiations have been held in Tehran about the efforts to ensure security along the common border, fight against terrorism, facilitate transportation, and raise the value of trade exchanges. We are delighted about the reconciliation between Tehran and Riyadh. Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia are responsible countries in the region. We call for the improvement of bilateral ties with Tehran through tangible mechanisms. We believe the two countries should fight terrorism in the region as powerful allies.
The Turkish official's visit to Tehran comes after his trip to Moscow. According to analysts, in view of the two countries' current trade volume of almost $15 billion, the volume of political exchanges between Iran, Turkey and Russia is increasing. And this indicates the will of the Tehran-Ankara-Moscow triangle to raise the level of cooperation and resolve some regional cases diplomatically.
Collaboration and synergy regarding Syria, mutual efforts to neutralize sanctions and pressures against both countries, and joint planning to deal with illegal immigrants are some of the areas in which Iran and Turkey have common interests that can bring both nations closer. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the significance of the meeting between the Iranian and Turkish foreign ministers in Tehran.
Now, allow me to invite a couple of guests to discuss this. Fuad Izzedi, professor at the University of Tehran. Joining me in Tehran, Onur Erim, is a public analyst in Istanbul. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Professor Izzedi, tell us about the significance of Iran-Turkey relations. And you know well that, especially during the Raisi administration, the government is adamant on boosting ties with all countries, in particular regionalist states. So how important is Tehran-Ankara relations?
Yes, I think the Raisi administration calls that having good relations with all Iran's neighbors. Turkey, obviously, is one of the neighbors that has had historically good relations with Iran, although there are some disagreements here and there, but generally, especially in economic exchanges, Iran and Turkey have been working very well with each other. A good portion of the discussions today based on the news conference was dedicated to economic issues. And given the fact that Iran and Saudi Arabia have normalized relations, the issue of having these three countries, all neighbors, work with each other on regional issues, not only on economic fronts, but also on security and political issues that come up in their trilateral relations, I think is a good idea. Turkey knows the value of having good relations with Iran, and I think Iran does the same. So although there are differences, occasionally the relations have actually improved in recent years, and I think as we go forward, the level of economic cooperation will increase.
Okay, Onur, another aspect apart from bilateral cooperation, the two foreign ministers also discussed regional cooperation, like Tehran saying it's ready to help Turkey deal with the crisis in the Caucasus region, the problem with the Azerbaijan Republic, for instance, the three countries, Iran, Turkey, Azerbaijan, can sit together and deal with the issue. Also, there is investment and also further trade between Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. I want you to weigh in on that, please.
I mean, it's no secret that Turkey and Iran had its own, fair share of differences in the past. And, going forward, there also may be some more differences in the future. But this should in no way, shape or form, should really prevent either of the countries from cooperating on what they can. Whenever there is a issue being discussed that I'm involved, that concerns the region, be it the Middle East and even Southern Caucasus, I always give a very same point I always underline. In this region, especially Middle East, if you want something permanent, if you want something sustainable, you have to make sure both Turkey and Iran is on board. Being pretty much for the Middle East, the only two nation states with an immense history by themselves and actually together, which had its good days and bad days, you do something without the concession of both Turkey and Iran, it will not be sustainable. So, as I said, it's no secret that Turkey has had its issues or differences with Iran, and vice versa, and it will probably continue to have on certain matters, but they should try to explore more and more ways on cooperation, not just for the bilateral relationship, but also for the regional improvements. I think if the two countries can work more and more together, it will benefit both countries, but even beyond that, it will actually benefit the region.
Okay. Professor Izadi, regarding the water rights, Foreman Samir Abdullahian talked about the Aras water to be distributed fairly, and they said that the experts would be meeting together to address the issue. Let's also speak about that a little bit.
The Middle East is facing a water crisis, and Iran is one of the countries in this part of the world that is suffering from lack of water. In some years, there are difficulties with actually providing enough water for the agricultural needs of the country. Turkey is doing relatively better. The climate of Turkey and the access to water is generally they're in a better shape. There are concerns with regard to water rights, whether it's between Iran and Turkey and Iraq, have their own issues. And, you know, we all live in the same neighborhood. So if Iran is suffering from water shortages, that's going to affect Iran. You know, in the last number of years, we have had sandstorms that are coming from the Iraqi side to Iran. And one of the reasons for these sandstorms, increased volume of these sandstorms, is the fact that not enough water is coming out of Turkey to Iraq. The problems, environmental problems of this region is going to affect all countries. And the best solution would be cooperation and discussions and, you know, international law that is available on these issues. And as long as there's this tendency to cooperate, I think some of these outstanding issues will be resolved.
I appreciate that. Fadi Zadi in Tehran and Onur Erim in Istanbul with their contribution.
Millions of Muslims from across the world are converging on the holy city of Karbala in Iraq to commemorate Arba'in, the 40th day after the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam, and the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Our correspondent Gisumi Shahmadi is also taking part in the pilgrimage, and she joined us earlier for more details on the Arba'in March this year.
We are about halfway to Karbala now. We left the Najaf. I told you that we are at pole 835. That is pretty much halfway through the route from Najaf to Karbala. The people that you see walking behind me have been walking for about 2 to 2.5 days in order to reach here. And they still have the same amount of route to walk in order to arrive in Karbala, hopefully in time for the Arba'in funeral ceremonies that will be held at Imam Hussein's holy shrine, which is, of course, next to Hazrat Abbas's holy shrine. And that particular part is called Bayn al-Hatamain, another very religious and important site where these pilgrims are hopeful to reach in time. We are expecting a very large number of people to gather in Bayn al-Haramain and at Imam Hussein's holy shrine on Arba'in itself. We do know that the numbers have been increasing steadily from about 11 to 15 million people converging on the holy sites on Arba'in 10 years ago to a number that is now close to 27 million people.
Bahrain is hosting Israel's foreign minister despite widespread anger in the kingdom over Manama's normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Eli Cohen is scheduled to meet Bahraini officials and inaugurate Israel's embassy there. He was scheduled to travel to Bahrain earlier, but it was postponed after Israel's far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, paid a controversial visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds. Bahrain, along with the United Arab Emirates, signed a U.S.-brokered normalization agreement with Israel in September 2020. Two more Arab states, Morocco and Sudan, joined the accord later. The normalization sparked criticism from other Muslim countries. They argued that the move would embolden Israel and harm regional peace and stability. Palestinians who have been facing Israeli crimes almost on a daily basis described the agreements as a stab in their back. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have decided to go on an open-ended hunger strike in protest of the regime's latest restrictive measures against inmates. The Palestinian Prisoner Society says the strike, starting from September 14th, aims to pile pressure on the Israeli authorities. It says the inmates want the reversal of restrictions and the restorations of their rights. That's days after the regime's far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, cut the number of family visits to Palestinian detainees from monthly to once every 2 months. Around 5,100 Palestinians, including women and children, are languishing in Israeli prisons. Hundreds of them are held under the so-called administrative detention, a policy the regime pursues to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. Meanwhile, the Hamas resistance movement expressed solidarity with the prisoners. It says the inmates will confront the Israeli decisions by all means possible. Russia has carried out fresh aerial attacks on Ukraine's positions in the Black Sea region, inflicting widespread infrastructure damage. The Russian Defense Ministry says four U.S.-made Ukrainian boats were destroyed. says they were carrying troops and traveling in the direction of the Crimean coast. Separately, the governor of Ukraine's Odessa region says that Russia hit the region with drones for several hours, setting several buildings on fire. Officials said 17 drones were shot down, but some hit their targets, causing damage but no casualties. In yet another development, Ukraine's president has sacked his defense minister. Volodymyr Zelensky cited what he called the need for new approaches as the war with Russia enters its 19th month. He has nominated Rustam Umerov, the former people's deputy, to become the new defense minister. Anti-French sentiment keeps growing in coup-hit Niger. People in the capital Niamey have held a third day of rallies against the presence of French troops in the country. The demonstrators chanted "Down with France." They also vowed to continue their rallies as they are determined to boot out the French troops. Anger at France is on the rise in the West African nation since a military coup in July. The junta has already ordered the French ambassador to leave Niger. The military rulers also on Friday took a swipe at the French government for meddling in Niger's internal affairs by supporting the ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Since Friday, tens of thousands of people have staged protests outside of a military base where French soldiers are stationed. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa says an independent inquiry has found baseless a U.S. allegation that the country supplied arms to Russia to help it fight Ukraine. Ramaphosa, in an address to the nation, said the probe found no evidence of arms shipment to Russia. He added the accusation had a damaging effect on South Africa's economy and its standing in the world. The inquiry came after the U.S. ambassador to South Africa in May alleged that weapons and ammunition were loaded onto a Russian ship that was docked at a Cape Town naval base. The ambassador's allegation sparked a diplomatic row between Pretoria and Washington. Ramaphosa said the ship had docked at the base to deliver equipment that had been ordered for the South African military in 2018. And that does it for World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
The Limelight. The U.S. regime is to send depleted uranium munitions to Ukraine, despite concerns that they could have a dramatic negative effect on public health and the environment. New shipments of the controversial weapon may be announced as early as next week. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Reuters, the U.S. is set to become the second country after the U.K. to greenlight shipments of depleted uranium shells to Ukraine, despite concerns that they could have a dramatic negative effect on public health and the environment. The munitions are intended for U.S. Abrams tanks, the first of which are expected to arrive in Ukraine in the coming weeks, the agency reported. According to several unnamed U.S. officials and a document cited by Reuters recently, the depleted uranium shells will be part of the next multi-million dollar arms donation, expected to be announced next week. The reported plan follows another highly controversial U.S. move to supply cluster munitions to Ukraine, which was criticized even by some of Washington's closest allies. According to RT, should the White House approve depleted uranium shells for Ukraine, it would follow an earlier move by the UK, which announced similar shipments in March. The UK's decision caused outrage in Moscow, with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov saying the delivery would take this escalation to a new and very serious stage. Russia's embassy in London accused the US and its allies of being willing to turn Ukraine into not only an anti-Russian military shooting range, but also a radioactive landfill. When the toxic shells first showed up in Ukraine, Moscow warned that the UK would be held accountable for the irreparable harm caused to civilians and soldiers alike. However, both the UK and the US officials have disputed the health hazards associated with DU shells, which use a dense uranium core to improve their armor-piercing capabilities, and dismissed studies indicating that the weapons are linked to a spike in cancer and birth defects in Iraq. According to RT, in the wake of the British move, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that Moscow would respond by placing tactical nuclear weapons in neighboring Belarus. He noted that in this respect, Moscow's actions do not differ from those of the US, which has stationed nuclear weapons in five European countries. Russia has said it would only remove the weapons if the US does the same with its own nuclear missiles in Europe and dismantles the infrastructure associated with them. Ukraine's Western backers claim that they are not directly participating in the conflict in Ukraine and have avoided providing certain weapons, notably fighter jets and long-range missiles that would risk provoking a direct clash with Russia. Nevertheless, they have sent Kiev more than $100 billion in arms, while ignoring Moscow's repeated warnings that every subsequent weapons package brings the US and NATO closer to active participation in the conflict. Furthermore, by enabling Ukraine's drone attacks on Russian civilians, Western nations have become sponsors of terrorism, according to the Kremlin. According to Insider, depleted uranium is a byproduct of uranium enrichment, and its extreme density gives rounds the ability to easily penetrate armor plating and self-ignite. The decision will likely cause controversy because of the dangers the munitions pose to civilians. The Biden administration faced similar backlash earlier this year when they provided Ukraine with cluster munitions. Cluster munition rocket attacks killed at least 8 civilians and wounded another 15 in Russian-controlled Izium last year, Human Rights Watch said. The International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons says inhaling or ingesting radioactive uranium dust can lead to detrimental health risks, including birth defects and cancers. Meanwhile, the UN nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, says that studies indicated that the existence of depleted uranium residues dispersed in the environment does not pose a radiological hazard to the population of the affected regions. The shells, which will come from U.S. excess inventory, would be funded by the Presidential Drawdown Authority, which lets the president make transfers from U.S. stocks without Congress approval in the case of an emergency. The $240 million to $375 million would add to the $43 billion in U.S. security assistance in Ukraine since the crisis started in 2022.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The United Nations is reporting that 2023 is already the deadliest year for Palestinians being killed by the Israeli regime since it started keeping records in 2006. Violence has been rampant against the native people of the land, and over 200 Palestinians have been killed so far this year. The regime continues to destroy more Palestinian homes and take their lands as they increase the construction of illegal settlements. However, pressure is mounting on the regime from many different directions. Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Saad Nim, professor of political science at Birzeit University, Ramallah. And Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let me start it off in Ramallah. Saad, when the United Nations issues such reports, what does it really mean if an international body is just pointing out the obvious but not trying to stop the source of the problem? What good does it do?
Good evening to you and to your guest also, Nick. Well, we know that the Israeli regime, and especially nowadays with this government, which is very far right wing government, the two major ministers are settlers themselves. So definitely the action of this government will be more and more atrocities against Palestinians. It's quite obvious that also the international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything that could help the Palestinian apart from, you know, condemnation or just expressing their concern about what's going on. But in reality, they are doing nothing. Next month, this month, on September, we have many sessions of the United Nations to address the issue of the Palestinian question. But we know that the international community so far is not going to do anything about it, since they are not, you know, willing really to take measures against Israel, like, you know, boycotting or to treat them as exactly as any other country around the world. But the double standard and the hypocrisy of the international community is a dominant factor here, which will prevent them of doing anything against Israel when it concerns the Palestinians.
Well, Mick, we have seen these apartheid forces killing more Palestinians, initiating more violent night raids, and destroying more Palestinians' homes. Is this due to desperation on the part of the regime that it cannot control the momentum of the Palestinian resistance, or is it from sheer arrogance?
I think it's to do with decades and decades of complete impunity. Mass killings in Cast Lead and Protective Edge, many massacres in between, all of which have gone unpunished. Many of them have been condemned in words by the United Nations, and sometimes even by the United States when they felt they had no alternative. But they've gone unpunished, and Israel only respects force. And you know, the United Nations has produced many excellent reports concluding that Israel is an apartheid state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, the one co-authored by Richard Falk a few years ago, which was suppressed by the UN under great pressure from the USA. The Israelis, I mean, talk about impunity. The UN publishes an annual list of shame of countries which have been abusing children during wartime. But Israel was not on the list this year, and it was not on previous lists, even though we have lots of examples of children being used as human shields, children being killed, children being arrested and so on, and abused in a way that no civilized society could tolerate. So, yes, Israel enjoys complete impunity. And I think we have to connect that over many decades to the current regime, as Saad Nimr mentions, with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are openly murderous, who've thrown over all the traces. I mean, whereas previous governments tried to cover their behaviour with a fig leaf, I mean, Saad and his friends and comrades in the West Bank could be arrested at any time by soldiers and a military administration. They could go to a court which had 100% virtually of guilty verdicts, and they had no chance whatsoever of justice. But Israel went through the forms of a democracy and the forms of a justice system. I think because they've got away with so much for so long, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, really, they've thrown all caution to the winds. And Ben-Gvir, of course, had a photograph of Goldstein on his wall, the guy who massacred scores of worshippers in the Al-Khalil Mosque. And, you know, he's now in charge of the police force. So they've thrown over all the traces. They have an open bloodlust, whereas previously we had very cultured and very rational ethnic cleansers who would try to carry out the whole thing with a kind of political cover and look towards America for limitations on what they did. This current generation, I think they have decided that they don't need to fear the so-called international community, the United Nations, because they look at the history and say, we get away with massacres anyway, so why bother placating them?
Okay. Well, Saad, Mick talked about Palestinian kids. I want to open that up a little bit more, because we've seen continued aggression against the children, intimidation, being arrested. It's as if the regime is either totally fearful of the future, are just totally losing control. I mean, your assessment of this side of things and why the kids are being targeted more and more.
Well, first of all, I don't think that they are fearing of the future so far, at least for now. But they are, you know, revealing their real face. As Mick has mentioned, previous governments, they tried to cover it up a little bit, but with this government, it's quite obvious, and they don't need even to cover it up. They reveal the real face of this kind of regime, this colonialist, racist regime. Now, the thing about the children, in particularly, the Israeli, they have different laws concerning the children in Israel and the children in the West Bank and Gaza. For the children in Israel, we know that everyone knows around the world, 18 years old, you are and under, it's a child. But in Palestine, they have three categories, 12 to 14, 14 to 16, 16 to 18. Starting with the last one, 16 to 18 is a full adult and he will face directly whatever any kind of atrocities by the regime, like arresting and trying and taking to court and even kept in adults' prisons. Now 12 to 14 they can arrest him but not try him yet, so they wait till he became 14, and after 14 the law allows them to try him in the court, like what happened with this with the person from Jerusalem, who was 13 when he was arrested, and they kept him in prison till he became 14, and then he was sentenced after he became 14. So this is, you know, a kind of two laws in regarding the children. So the abuse of the children is really very high, and till now we are talking about 35 child were killed by the Israeli from the beginning of this year. Now, why they are doing that? Because they don't care. Basically, they don't see the Palestinians as humans. Dehumanizing the Palestinians is one of the things that the Israeli are really masters in. And they don't care. And they don't even, you know, think about children or non-children or whoever, you know, when it comes to the Palestinian. They treat us not like as a human. They don't think it twice. Their hand on the trigger is very light. And they can, you know, use the weapon immediately against any Palestinian at any under any kind of circumstances. Regardless, they can, you know, make sure that it's what's going on or not. Like the guy who was killed, and they said he had a weapon in his hand, and apparently he had a bottle of water. And because of that, they thought it is a weapon and they killed him. After that, they make sure that it was a bottle of water. So it's so easy for them, because the main issue here is the dehumanize the Palestinians. This is on the one side. On the other side, they feel that they are the only victims in this conflict. And if you are the only victim, so you blame even us as Palestinians for killing the children. See what you make us do? We are killing our children now because, you know, because they don't want to see that there are any other victims but them. They are only the victims. And lastly, the Israeli deeply believe that they are the chosen people and they have the right to do whatever they like to do whenever it needs to do. So with these kind of myths in their heads, definitely they will live, you know, normally with what they are doing in killing the Palestinians. So it's kind of normal in this kind of a state. And this government just revealed the real face of the state. Maybe we started to see now how ugly it was because of these ministers and because of this government. But in reality, since the beginning, since 1948, when it was established, or let me say, since the Zionist movement was established, it is a racist movement from day one when it was established.
Yeah, unbelievable. I'm just listening to you, and I'm remembering the case of Ahmed Manasra, who was 14, I believe, and I think it's been about 7 or 8 years that he has been in Israeli prisons, unfortunately, hopefully, that he can be freed soon. Mick, we look at Zionism, which is a racist ideology, and we've seen continuous examples of the racism and discrimination against Palestinians, but not only do the Palestinians experience this racism, but non-European Western Jews also experience this type of discrimination. Yesterday we saw an incident with some Africans from Eritrea, but we've seen other cases, the Ethiopian Jews who experience actually unbelievable discrimination of the regime. I mean, isn't this indicative in general of just a racist apartheid regime all around?
Look, I don't have the vocabulary in order to explain the intensity of Israeli racism. It is far and away the most racist society on the surface of the earth, and the competition is quite extreme. Eli Yishai, an Israeli minister of the interior, nor a drunk in a pub. He said that the problem with Muslims, and he had many problems with Muslims, probably that they existed was a problem for him, but he said the problem is that Muslims don't accept that Israel is a white man's country. The Minister of the Interior, the top man in the government to deal with citizens in terms of justice. Israel has a history of Jewish supremacy over all non-Jews in the whole land of Palestine, but within that, it has a very developed history of European supremacy against non-European Jews, and it's very long-standing. It's there from the very beginning. It's quite undeniable once you look at the history. The guy who's known as the father of settlement in the land of Israel, Arthur Rupin, who did more than anybody else to dispossess Palestinians in the early years of the Zionist project. He used to measure Jewish noses to prove that European Jews were superior to Iraqi and Yemeni and Middle Eastern Jews. He was an absolutely determined Jewish supremacist and a white supremacist as well. Yemeni children have been kidnapped by the hundred, probably the thousands. And there's many Jewish Yemenis who cry to this day. They were kidnapped when they came to Palestine as Zionists and taken from their mothers in the hospitals and given to European Jews to bring them up as Europeans. Kidnapping, stealing, telling the mothers the children were dead, and the people are alive to this day in Israel, knowing that their children have been stolen from them because they, the Yemenis, were deemed to be inferior to Europeans. And also, I mean, black African Jews, they suffer racist supremacy as well. Not only in Israel, but we have a huge problem of racism in Britain. But I tell you, here, you could not get demonstrations at schools because one black child was going to be admitted to the school. You get that in Israel. The intensity of some sections of the Jewish population towards black children is extreme. Now, if you add all these together, you get a picture of popular racism in Israel, which I think it's important to explain. I mean, popular racism is not from the state. The state contributes to it by dispossessing Palestinians. It's a very racist state indeed. But popular racism is not exactly the same. I mean, in America, black people were lynched and murdered in popular public parties where people would drink alcohol, hundreds would gather, and they would kill a black person or two and hang them from trees very publicly. This didn't happen to Jews even in Nazi Germany. So popular racism in Israel is extreme. Of course, the main victims are Palestinians by a royal mile. But Yemeni Jews, black people, people who other minorities as well, they suffer from the racism of a settler colonial state, because a settler colonial state must imbue the dominant, the supremacist population with the most extreme racism, because you cannot dispossess and steal from people their land, their lives, without making the dominant population hate them and deal with them as subhuman. Mm. If I may make a final point, if I may, before the rise of the slave trade in Britain, in Europe, you didn't have the same kind of racism that you got after the slave trade. It's because black people were bought and sold as like dogs that racism needed to follow. And I think that explains much of the popular racism in the most racist society in the world.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines.
featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Saad, this has been the 35th week of protests against the Netanyahu regime on Saturday and its judicial reforms. One of the speakers who spoke at the demonstration in Tel Aviv said, quote, "Whenever you look, the madness, the fanaticism, the Masonic extremism, all these sick evils are only increasing." Your thoughts on her assessment?
Yes, no, Israel is in a big problem regarding what's going on in the last few months when Netanyahu is trying now to change the laws. And we are talking about, like, you know, something like around 200 laws which he need to change. He started with only one last month. But now he's also intending to do, though he said that he's going to postpone the whole thing. But in reality, the Israeli public do know that he's a liar, and he's not going to, change his mind about it, because his life is about that. Changing the law, it means that he would try to escape the trial, because he's charged with three major charges, and he might be, you know, imprisoned because of that. So he wanted to be prime minister as much as he could till he changed the laws, which will allow him to continue in his political life. So he don't care about Israel. He don't care about even, anyone else, because he wants just to save his neck by changing the laws. And the Israeli do know that if he started to meddle in the laws and in the judicial system in Israel, it means that, they are not talking about democracy anymore at all, though I don't think at all that Israel is a democracy, but still they are trying to project that in front of the whole international community that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, which is really, really not true. But at least they think, or they want to believe, that their country is a democracy. And what is going on, it's going to hinder this kind of democracy. Now, the implication of these demonstrations so far, after 35 weeks of continuous demonstrations, now we started to see that the Likud party, Netanyahu's party, is starting also to send his own supporters in order sometimes to have clashes with the demonstrators, not necessarily in Tel Aviv, but in other cities where demonstrators are a little bit smaller in amount. However, but the other implications are really, really very important, and we have to look at them really carefully, because we are talking about, you know, a huge sector of the pilots in Israel are refusing to join and to join the army, and especially in the reserve. And they declare it, more than 500 pilots, they declare that they are not going to join the training or anything else, which many reports saying that the Israeli army and some of the officers in the Israeli army, they are saying that we are facing, you know, some problems because of these kind of decisions, not only by pilots, but also other high-rank officers who refuse also to join the training and to join, you know, the army. So all that will put, you know, Israel definitely in a kind of real turmoil and a big problem, and all that because of Netanyahu and his own personal opinion about the law.
Well, Mick, there is growing anxiety amongst the Zionist population, however. According to a poll by an Israeli TV station, more than 28% of those polled say they are considering leaving there to go to another country, and more than 56% believe that a civil war is possible. What do you make of these results?
I say excellent. For 35 weeks now, we've seen a major clash between two Zionist blocs, between those who wish to create a second Nakba immediately, very quickly, and finish what started in 1948, we can say. And the other bloc, which gazes into that with horror and wishes to continue with business as usual. I mean, I spoke to an Israeli at the Edinburgh Festival last week who was putting on a play telling the truth about the Israeli army, the brutality, the racism, etc. And he said, look at all these demonstrations on the street, hundreds of thousands of people. I said, yes, but they're fighting about how to crush the Palestinians. He said, yeah, okay, that's true. And he quickly agreed that Israel had never been a democracy. It had been a democracy with voting rights for Jews, but not for Palestinians. And I think the possibility of the Zionist bloc splitting and the possibility of extreme tension can possibly lead to a weakening of the Israeli state. And this state, which has strode the Middle East as the regional dominant power for a very long time, crushed the Arab armies in 67 and so on, anything which weakens that state has to be something that we should welcome. And the Palestinians toiling and suffering under that state may well benefit from it becoming weaker. And okay. The possibility of a civil war, I think there's already an incipient civil war, because the old elite who are opposed to Netanyahu, the European white elite, the people who control the highest levels of the economy, of the army and so on, they don't want to surrender to Netanyahu's base, which isn't the old elite and wants to challenge that old elite. And I think there's something very fundamental going on. And my final point would be, if the Palestinians ceased resisting, if they were not resisting in a parallel universe, they're not resisting, but in this one they are, that's the cause of the split inside the Zionist bloc. The Palestinians have caused it by resisting, by refusing to go out into the night,
sorry to interrupt you, Mick, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science, Beresat University out of Ramallah, and Mick Napier, co-founder, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Brother Suhail is with me in the studio for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Suhail. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you very much.
Okay, Brother Suhail, today, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the impacts and the effects of the cyberspace on the family relations. You know, the digital technology, the interconnected digital technology and online world, cyberspace, cell world, and all these virtual world social networks, you know, are an inseparable part of today's life of the people, the modern lifestyle of the people. What negative effects or positive effects do you think might the cyber world have on family relations and the family ties?
Okay, so first, let us see what in this current usage that we use the word cyberspace, what it means.
Yes.
So according to the research that I've done, it's the term cyberspace is a global network of interdependent information technology infrastructure, telecommunications network, and computer process systems.
Okay.
Cyberspace represents computer-based channels, computer networks, or virtual reality, as you said. The term has become a conventional name to describe anything associated with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that has to do with the internet is cyberspace.
Cyberspace, that's right.
Now,
what about the effects of this on the family ties and the family relations? Usually, all the people nowadays, you know, from father, mother, the parents, the children, you know, are looking at the screens and the cell phones in their hands. So,
a person like me, who was born in 91,
mm-hmm.
I came across cyberspace at the year of 2005,
okay,
when I was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
We had this Nokia N80 series.
Yes.
These were the small phones that time. That time we didn't have
internet connections, no Androids. Internet, no social. Yes.
We had this other phones that were not Android.
Yes.
I forgot the name, but it was something. At that time, what we have WhatsApp right now, we used to have an application called the MiG-33.
Mm-hmm.
That was a China-based application where people would come and communicate to different people from different parts of the world. And this is from personal experience, once the app of telecommunicating started in the world, we had seen drastic changes to human emotions and human interaction between themselves. So a family is not a personal-based institution. It's a community-based institution because you're more than one person. And normally before life, before cyberspace, was that you would find anything to be busy.
Mm-hmm.
Studying, talking, chatting. When I say chatting, I don't mean today's chatting.
Yes.
We would sit outside our houses and chat. We would go outside our homes and play games, football or stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I say games, I mean physical activities.
Mm, yes.
Not the games that have become mature and renowned today. So these were the things that we used to do those times. And in those times, around 2000s, 2004, 3, if we had a phone, the phone was used only for two things: calling and texting.
Yes.
And because texting would cost, you would text very less.
Yes.
But when the application arised, like the example of MiG-33, when we see the applications like MiG-33 coming, where now it's telling you text with no cost.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So what you needed to do is